Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSB Magazine. You're listening to a new Redefining Security podcast. Have you ever thought that we are selling cybersecurity insincerely, buying it indiscriminately, and deploying it ineffectively? Perhaps we are. So let's look at how we can organize a successful InfoSec program that integrates people, process, technology, and culture to drive growth and protect business value. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Imperva is the cybersecurity leader whose mission is to protect data and all paths to it with a suite of integrated application and data security solutions. Learn more at imperva.com.
EdgeScan offers continuous vulnerability intelligence as a service, accurately identifying vulnerabilities and exposures across the full stack. All threats are verified by cybersecurity experts, providing exploitable risk and remediation guidance, virtually false positive free. Learn more at edgescan.com.
Archer empowers organizations to manage multiple dimensions of risk on one platform with on-premises and software as a service offerings, and quickly implement industry standard processes and best practices for advanced risk management maturity, informed decision-making, and enhanced business performance. Learn more at archerirm.com.
All right, here we are. It's a new episode of Redefining Security here on ITSB Magazine. And I have a feeling we're going to talk about being frustrated and how to deal with some of that. And perhaps, just like when we talk about risk, is it possible to transfer some frustration somewhere else? I am not a practitioner, but I speak to quite a few, and today we have somebody who's done a lot in this space, red team, blue team, and has written some code and some automation and ultimately a book to help practitioners deal with some of the frustrations they have sitting in front of them on a daily basis. So I'm thrilled to have Dan join us today for this conversation. Dan, thanks a million.
Yeah, thank you, Sean. I really appreciate the opportunity.
And before we get into the book and the work that you've done, maybe just a quick background on who Dan is and what gets you up in the morning. What are you working on?
Yeah, so I've been a programmer for a long time. And then as I was getting into college, I started to explore the security space. And around that time, I got into pen testing and red teaming. And man, it was just such a interesting and passionate and fun job. And you know, you say what gets you up in the morning, red teaming is, it's just so fun when you get into it too. And then it's such a fast changing world where all these new techniques and new tools are coming out all the time. So that really like drove me for a bunch of years just getting into this research. And you know, it's such a rush when you break into something, and obviously you're doing it for a company, and then the rush goes away when you have to write the report. But it was such a fun job and fun career. And from that, I actually got into incident response, and I started doing the other side of, you know, security, which is catching people breaking into systems. And through the incident response, like, I just learned all these like neat tricks. And, you know, I have a formal background in security. I have a degree in information security. But it was once I actually got into incident response, I started learning like little deceptions and ways to kind of flip the game back on the attacker. And I think a lot of those lessons motivated this book. It, like, just the way I view security is kind of this two sides of the same coin perspective. And I think that comes out in the book.
And what was the catalyst for writing the book? What prompted you to, I mean, it's no small feat to start putting words on paper and getting it to a point where it actually tells a story and provides something for somebody to actually benefit from. So what was the catalyst behind it?
Yeah. So I've been building a bunch of these lessons learned, and I wanted to start to get involved with like the next generation of security and teaching new people. So, you know, about 8 years ago, I got involved with the CCDC competition, which is the Collegiate Cyber Defense Competition. Kind of like the NCAA of, you know, college basketball, but with cybersecurity. So you have 10 regions around the United States, and all of these different teams have, like all these different schools send teams to these regions. And it's usually like, let's just say 10 teams per region, so 100 teams total, and then the best filter up to the nationals. And CCDC is a defensive-based competition. The student teams are just securing a network. They kind of inherit this IT network, and they're already under attack from these attackers. And the way I got involved in, I was doing the red teaming for them. So we're not actually competing against the students. The students are competing against each other. I like to equate it to a sailing competition. They're sailing, and we're just, you know, the force of nature. We are the storm in their way. So I was doing this for a number of years, red teaming against these student teams. And I felt like there were so many lessons learned that if I could give these student teams, they would be able to level themselves up. Because the life cycle of a student is they're on this team for 4 years and then they move on. So a lot of the lessons that they're learning, you know, the new students coming in might not necessarily pick up. So I figured if I could capture some of these lessons in a text and, like, you know, new students coming in can kind of get that leg up right away and understand some of the techniques that we're going to use and better prepare themselves for the storm.
Yeah, and it's constant learning, right? And maybe you can touch on this because the tools are always changing for the bad actors, right? And sometimes we have access to the same tools as red teamers. And perhaps it's, I'll say, easy to prepare yourself as a blue teamer if you know what the tools are being used, right? And if you have a red team going after you using those tools, you might kind of find your way and find a groove there. But then exactly. Reality strikes, right? There's a new tool, a new process, and somebody's found a way in and around that you didn't know existed yet. So how is what you've done in the book, and I know you have a bunch of coding as well, how's what you've done help both the red team and the blue team prepare for reality, this storm that's coming, right?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head too. Like, if you can predict what the attacks are, you can get ahead of the game and you can kind of outthink your opponent. And we talk about this a lot in the book, but specifically, like, chapter 7 goes into threat modeling. And, you know, if you're doing the research and you're looking at this CCDC red team, for example, you might see people on the team like Raphael Mudge, the creator of Cobalt Strike. So you might say, hey, wow, these guys are going to use Cobalt Strike. And then you can go out and do threat modeling against Cobalt Strike, which a number of teams have done. And it's so cool, like, some of the research that these students have done. Like, one tool that I really like is called Beacon Hunter. And Beacon Hunter will look at the default state of a Cobalt Strike beacon, where it goes into this sleep delayed state. And it will catch these beacons on these threads where it sleeps and delays this thread. So it's just this, exactly like you said, this great application of threat modeling where these students kind of get in front of the offense. But, you know, you also hit on a great point, which is everything, it's always kind of changing, and sometimes your predictions aren't right. So one of the big things I talk about in the book is contingency planning. So, like, on the offensive side for CCDC, I'll have, you know, two or three command and control infrastructure set up. I'll have some of them in the network, some of them on the internet. I'll use two different tools. And the whole idea is it's a fallback plan. It's preparing for that worst case scenario where the students know exactly what I'm doing and I have to change my tactics on the fly. And it's preparing for that. So I talk about that a lot in the book, where it's, even if these specific tools aren't used, or, you know, the other team has countermeasures against these tools, you should prepare contingency plans. It gets more difficult because on the defensive side, there's a lot of infrastructure, so it's harder to set up contingency plans. But I think you see that in practice with things like defense in depth, where you have multiple layers of controls in case, like, one control gets bypassed in some way.
Now, is it a matter of mindset, looking for behavior, watching for landmines being trips. You mentioned defense in depth, and I don't think you've said deception, but I presume deception is in there as well, where yep. we're getting the attackers to trip over a line or access something that doesn't really matter if they do, but it lets us know that they're there. How much of it is it a mindset of preparing for what could happen, looking for the signs, versus looking for specific actions or a log from an event, an IDS, or a log from a firewall that would trip us or tip us off?
Yeah, again, that's an incredible point. A lot of the book talks about deception, and then what I try to talk about within the context of deception is checking your own biases, right? Is the computer telling me something that's true? And let's say you have some tools to get telemetry from this machine. For example, you wanted to dump process memory to understand if something's living in a process. The book talks about rootkits and ways to hide this information, hide this information from the defender as they're using these tools to try and find this out. So another thing, kind of that whole idea of contingency planning, is you have to have multiple methods to check your assumptions. Really, you have to have multiple tools or the ability to say, is my system integrity there? You know, is my system lying to me? Because a lot of these techniques, when you're in these competitions, are very deceptive based, like rootkits. The whole idea is you're wrestling for this root control of a computer. And because both people have the same level of access, you want to lie to the general perception so that they don't find you. A lot of the book talks about exactly that, which is confirming what your tools are telling you through multiple ways. Like, does the network telemetry make sense with what I'm seeing on the host?
And I presume you kind of walk through some of that stuff in the book to help blue teamers, of course, but then perhaps even red teamers do better at not getting detected.
We do both in the book. The book takes a very adversarial approach. So purple teaming has gotten very popular. And in my mind, purple teaming really is both teams working together. It's creating this adversarial roadmap, right? Like your adversary emulation. But then it's walking through it with the blue team and showing them where you can best attack them. My book doesn't necessarily take that approach. My book takes a more aggressive approach, where it shows the red team how to bypass these defenses. It shows them how to use these different rootkits or different tools. The rootkit example we use is called Reptile, which is a loadable kernel module in Linux. And, you know, we really show the operators how to use it as an effective tool. And then I do take the blue team approach, and I do show techniques for catching Reptile specifically, but also in general, like how would you hunt a rootkit? But from both perspectives, I take a very serious perspective, as opposed to purple teaming, where it's a little bit more like the gloves are off with purple teaming, or you know, you have the gloves on, you kind of are wearing a little bit of handcuffs when you're doing purple teaming. You don't want to be as aggressive. If that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then tabletop exercises are, I'll say, a best practice in theory. I don't know how often they're run in the real world. Your thoughts on that, and can the content in the book help with some of those tabletop exercises? I'm thinking of an environment where you don't want to do it on the production environment, right? So you probably have to set something up on the side that looks similar, but maybe there's some tools, I don't know, Hack the Box or things like, I don't know. Do you get in any of those types of things where you can actually help the teams run through some of these scenarios, so it's not just theoretical from the book?
Yeah. I think tabletops are very important, so you can kind of work through these scenarios. But the book really focuses on the practical, because when you get into the practical, there's so many scenarios that you wouldn't encounter in a tabletop that you might do in the real world. Or like a great example that I show in the book is a real incident response scenario I had, where we had somebody cloning our website basically every day and standing up phishing sites. And it was very difficult to stop these new phishing sites from coming up. And what we did is we actually backdoored the JavaScript on the main website so that when they cloned it, we would then have code running on their new site. And we used this to kind of get ahead of the attacker. And, you know, if you're thinking of OODA loops or like observe, orient, detect, act, it's a fighter pilot technique. When you're thinking of OODA loops, if you can get inside their thought process, like, right, like they're cloning the website and our code is already there. We're a step ahead of them every step of the game. I think those practical scenarios, some of these techniques shine a little more. You wouldn't really do any of this stuff in like a red team or a tabletop, if that makes sense, because it's a little too extreme.
Yeah, it does make sense. And which prompts the question, how can you prepare for that scenario if you don't know what to do?
Yeah.
And then in the heat of the moment, when something bad's happening, how do you figure it out at that point even?
Yeah. So. And this is something we repeat a lot in this CCDC world. And it's just critical thinking. Like a lot of times when you're in this incident response mind state, yeah, this is good and bad, but you're kind of knee jerk and you're just going through things, you know, right? You have some playbooks and you might have some routines. And one thing, Dave Cohen, the leader of the CCDC National Red Team, and he's an incident responder for his day job. One thing he always stresses is slow down, take a break, and do critical thinking, like root cause analysis. How did the attackers get in? What are they leveraging? Where are they living? And I think by slowing down and doing this critical analysis, you get it out of these knee-jerk routines and you start to think about, who is my actor? Who is this threat? What do they want? And how can you stop them? You know what I mean?
Yeah, and let's talk about stopping them, because maybe, well, there's stopping them before they start, and then there's stopping them once they've started. And I was joking a little bit as we kicked this off of the frustrations of a red teamer trying to get in or a blue teamer trying to protect against that. How do we transfer that frustration back to the attacker so that they don't even want to embark on that endeavor in the first place? And if they do, the hurdles are so high that they don't want to proceed.
Yeah. It's exactly that. You can not, you know, a lot of times you're not just trying to block the attacker, because people are very smart and they're going to work around your block. So they're going to figure out a way to get to the goal, outside of the controls. So one thing that I try to introduce in the book is just frustrating attackers. If an attacker gets frustrated enough with the system, they will move on to an easier system. It'll be a waste of their time. I think a great example of this, again, is CCDC. You look at the size differences between the teams. Each red cell has 3 team members, and each blue cell has 5 team members. So there's a number of situations where we'll have a blue team just constantly reverting a VM. And this gets very frustrating for us as an attacker, because it's like, everything I'm doing is ineffective. They just revert it right away. Sometimes we can work around this. Like, we can automate whatever the attack is we're doing. And then if they don't have it automated, they're wasting a body doing these reverts when we've automated it and moved on. But another example of the frustrations is a blue team tool called port spoof. So traditionally on the red team, when you're doing your network scan, you'll use something like Nmap or mass scan to find a bunch of open ports on the machine that you're attacking. And the traditional advice in that situation is close down all the ports you're not using and reduce it to just the few services you can protect, which is great advice. It's timeless and it's very strong advice. But one of the techniques that we talked about in the book is doing the opposite and actually opening all of the ports and spoofing this information. So now when the attacker scans you, they basically get overwhelmed with port information and they have to do a lot more analysis to understand what is a real service versus what is a fake service. And it, you know, what became a target where they only had like a few targets on that machine, now they have hundreds, and it's very hard for them to differentiate what is a real target from a fake target.
So you've mentioned this a few times now, just the idea that the information you're seeing, the logs you're reading, the alerts you're parsing, whatever it is, may seem like something, right? And I don't want to use the word false positive, but it may show that there's something going on, but it may not be exactly what you should be looking for or at. And you said you need to validate that. How do teams get a handle on that? And I mean, is there a way to automate some of those things, or are there tools you use to could trigger a potential response?
Right. So what you want to do is collect different telemetry from like different hosts or different parts of the network. And then a big part of it is just knowing, you know, I think Sand says this a lot, but know normal and then find evil. And a big way to know normal is collecting all this data, because then you can kind of compare it across your whole fleet for all your hosts. And that can kind of help bubble up abnormalities or things that might be missing on a particular system that should be there, or anomalies that are running on a different system that shouldn't be there. I think the unsung hero really here is logging pipelines and this defensive automation of telemetry, bringing all of this data back from these different sensors, these different hosts, into a single place that a blue team can analyze it or respond automatically.
So coding has been a point that's run through this entire conversation. And I'm always curious how much coding skills are required for security practitioners, analysts, and responders. It sounds like it's a necessary skill. And in your experience, do we have enough of that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's room for everybody. You know, like, I don't think you necessarily need coding experience to do a lot of these operations. For example, you can have an operator that runs a C2 framework, and they could have like a team that does development for them. Same thing with like an incident response analyst. I think it's very viable for somebody to become an incident response analyst without not having a lot of coding experience. That said, I think a really large theme that I talk about all over the book is innovation. And it's so easy to innovate with modern tech stacks because there's so much code. And an innovation can be anything. It can be improving the process or just making the process simpler for somebody else to understand, or even automating a simple process that already exists. So I do think having the ability to code will help you innovate much faster. And those innovations are the game changers. You know, one thing that we talk about in the book is we write a Metasploit RC script to not only throw an exploit, but then throw a stage 2 after the exploit hits. And we automate that whole process of going instantly from exploit to deploying our stage 2 and upgrading our session or our foothold on the target. And that type of automation revolutionizes teams. Like on the CCDC red team, we did have a breakout time of 2 minutes, which meant from the original compromise of one machine, we would get credentials and be able to spread laterally across the network within 2 minutes, which is exceptionally fast. It's a very fast breakout time. And I attribute that to our automation, to our preparedness. One thing I also talk about in the book is this principle of time, particularly with computers. There's a lot of downtime and waiting, and then the moments of conflict can almost be lightning fast. You know, an incident response could be a day to 7 days, and that timeline is very critical. So on the red team, we spend a lot of our off time automating techniques, so that way when we get to that critical hour, we can act, you know, with lightning speed. So I think there's a big benefit there, but it's not critical, if that makes sense, to do the job.
Yeah, definitely does. And yeah, preparedness for the storm, right? A downpour may happen arrive in minutes, last few minutes, and be gone. But the damage could be done.
Exactly.
So being prepared for that. So Dan, as we get close to the end here, I didn't really say specifically who the book is for. Is it for engineers? Is it for red teamers? Is it for blue teamers? Is it their managers who say, these are the scenarios, these are the stories we care about.
Yeah.
Come team with me and help me build the arc.
Yeah. It really was originally for these CCDC students. It was for these teams competing in these attack and defense competitions. But I think the book is useful to any offensive person or any defensive person or even a system administrator. If you would ever find yourself in the position where there could be somebody else on your computer and you don't want that person there, or you want to verify the integrity of your computer, I think the book would be extremely useful for you. For example, let's say there's two people on a machine and they both have root control. The book is very good at giving you explicit techniques to kick that person off your machine, changing passwords, blocking their IP addresses, kind of your basic blocking and tackling. And I think those are important skills for anybody using a computer, you know, that wants to, you know, make sure nobody else is using their computer.
Yeah, makes sense. And the book, for everybody listening, it's titled Adversarial Tradecraft in Cybersecurity: Offense versus Defense in Real-Time Computer Conflict. Written by Dan, based on his experience. I presume, Dan, you had some other folks help you as well. Really great to chat with you. I'm always interested in the gaming aspect of things, where we're actually playing this game out, right? Even if it's only looks real, to have that practice and to have that understanding and to get that mindset, that's going to come extremely useful when that moment arises. So really appreciate you sharing a bit about the book, a bit about some of the learnings that folks can find in it. And any final word from you? How can folks find you? It's on pre-order on Amazon, I believe.
Yeah, it's on
Amazon. Or it's in stock now. There we go.
Yep. You can find me on Twitter at 1NJCTION, injection with a 1. I also write a blog at lockbox, lockbox.blogspot.org. And if you pick up the book and you like the book and you review the book, I have a small site, and I'll be featuring those reviews on the site. So please read it and let me know what you think. If I'm off the mark, or if you think I said some pretty inspiring stuff, I'd really appreciate it.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? Get people to think and hopefully find something they can take action on as well. So, Dan, really appreciate it. Thanks for doing the work, putting the book together. Hopefully folks get a chance to read it and do that review for you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about it. I really appreciate it.
And for those listening, thanks for joining us. There will be links to the book and other resources like Dan's blog. And check those out in addition to the book. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Catch you on the next one.
Archer empowers organizations to manage multiple dimensions of risk on one platform with on-premises and software as a service offerings, and quickly implement industry standard processes and best practices for advanced risk management maturity, informed decision making, and enhanced business performance. Learn more at archerirm.com.
EdgeScan offers continuous vulnerability intelligence as a service, accurately identifying vulnerabilities and exposures across the full stack. All threats are verified by cybersecurity experts, providing exploitable risk and remediation guidance, virtually false positive free. Learn more at edgescan.com.
Imperva is the cybersecurity leader whose mission is to protect data and all paths to it, with a suite of integrated application and data security solutions. Learn more at imperva.com.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Redefining Security Podcast. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share itspmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.